This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, I'm Howard Burton, host and creator of Ideas Roadshow, and I'm delighted to present the following Pandemic Perspectives podcast, one of a special series of 24 podcasts that, together with our Pandemic Perspectives documentary and my book Pandemic Perspectives, A Filmmaker's Journey in 10 Essays, make up our comprehensive Pandemic Perspectives project, looking at the COVID-19 crisis from a spectrum of different angles. Today's Pandemic Perspectives podcast features Imperial College Respiratory Infections researcher John Tregoning, author of the acclaimed book Infectious: Pathogens and How We Fight Them, which he somehow managed to publish in the depths of the pandemic to help so many people, myself most definitely included, get a better handle on the profound challenges facing our immune system in the midst of the coronavirus crisis. Those who have been following these Pandemic Perspectives podcasts will recognize that a constant point of criticism invoked by our guests is the generally poor level of science communication demonstrated throughout the pandemic. But suffice it to say that John has done his utmost to successfully push matters in an unequivocally positive direction. I thought we'd begin at the beginning, logically enough, with your interest in not just immunology, but biology and medical science in general. You mentioned in your book that you were captivated by immunology through some book that you read 25 years ago. But perhaps we can go even further back and just get a sense of your interest in the biological sciences writ large. Did you always have an interest in that? And how did that begin for you?
Yeah, I think I did. I always enjoyed sciences, and at school, kind of between 8 and 13, I had a very inspirational science teacher called Mr. Parkin, and he let us do fairly open-ended science experiments. So he we'd go off and collect woodlice from the local park and then test whether they liked dark or light, or kind of put them in this sort of habitat type experiment. But he also kind of gave us free rein to the chemical store, so we could just go and take bits of sodium and blow them up and do all sorts of things that you probably wouldn't be allowed to do now. And so that was the kind of founding of it. And then I guess it was a bit of like, I was good at it, so I carried on doing it through school and then into university. And then I enjoyed it at university, but I was kind of distracted by all the other university stuff as well. So I didn't focus on it quite as much. I was definitely surrounded by amazing minds and didn't quite click at the time. And I think some of it was, you go from being the sort of top of your pool at school to then suddenly being surrounded by lots and lots of bright people, and it you suddenly feel quite average. I wasn't quite mature enough to cope with that. But then I was lucky enough to do a PhD, and I think it was that during the PhD that it sort of clicked a bit more that that's the path I wanted to do. So I enjoyed it as a child, but I had no real sense of what I wanted to do until I was about 30.
Right. And at any point, did you flirt with the idea of going to medical school? I know, obviously, you wound up as a researcher, and you teach medical students, as I understand now, in immunology. But was that a career path that you had considered at some point?
No, I never wanted to be a medical doctor. I'm more interested in the questions at the front end than the translation at the back end. The problem solving really fascinates me rather than necessarily kind of where those problems end up.
So I'd like to move to infectious now. I have a fair amount of questions regarding the book, and it's written obviously in a way to engage non-specialists, and it's written obviously in a way to engage non-specialists in this particularly curious time that we're living in, namely the pandemic, and you leverage that, and we'll get into that obviously. But before we begin, you talk a little bit about your motivations for writing that, but I think it would be useful for you to give a general synopsis of what prompted you to write that and how that process unfolded.
Yeah, I think it needs to sort of rewind about 6 years. I do really enjoy writing, and I had really enjoyed writing. I used to write for the college newspaper. I did a bit when I was doing my PhD. And then that side of me kind of, I didn't do as much for about 10 years. During that time, sort of the science writing enjoyed, so writing the kind of research papers, and I kind of was enjoying that, but I about 6 years ago, I was having a bit of a kind of wobble in my research career, as is fairly standard. You know, getting research funding is challenging, and all of those kind of aspects of it. And I spoke to a friend, and he said, "Well, what else do you enjoy in that? Maybe you could go back to the writing and start developing that as a kind of side project." And so I set up a blog and started writing mostly about kind of science careers, but a bit about my research in a kind of lay perspective. So I was kind of building up this sort of portfolio of work. And then that sort of built up and built up. And then from the blog, I started writing for Times Higher Education and for Nature Careers. So it was sort of slightly bigger, well, much bigger audiences, and developed sort of portfolio from there. And then I thought I actually then wanted to write a book, and it's always been something in my mind that I'd like to have done. I had an idea for a book, and I shopped it around, and nobody was really interested in it. And I was lucky enough to meet the person who became my agent, who's called Caroline, and she suggested a completely different book in November 2019. She said, "Well, the thing you're talking about," so I was talking about like a science career kind of how-to type book. She said, "Well, that's quite niche, but how about writing a book about vaccines or antibiotics?" And at the time, I didn't quite have the headspace and wasn't really interested in it. And then you roll forward 6 months, and then suddenly my academic lab shut down, and actually lots of people were kind of asking me questions. And I thought, well, I am in a position to kind of communicate some of the science that people are asking about, and went back to Caroline and said, "Yes, can we have a look at that idea and develop it further?" And then she kind of helped me do the sales pitch, and then that led into the deal with One World, and then that led to the book.
I see. Well, so it was quite propitious, really, that you had already been thinking about these things and developing contacts in the industry. I thought we'd move on to some questions, and I have quite a lot of them about the book, and then more general questions about what's happening in the world today and what we can do about it. I hope to solve all of the world's problems by the time we end, so no pressure. So my first question, I'm going to start on the silly side of things, because you write in a very lighthearted way, and so it seems appropriate for me to pick up on some of that. So my first question is, what have you got against North London? You make a few cutting comments about, well, at least one thing. I think there was something from Mill Hill, and, well, at least that's one good thing that comes out of North London. So I have known Londoners that come from south of the Thames, and their view is that anything north of the Thames is toxic and should be avoided at all costs. Are you one of those people?
by accident. I grew up outside London, but then when I moved into London, I spent most of my life south of the Thames, and therefore it grew that bias for anti-North London. So I think it's just a, you know, parochialism. I'm sure there are things that are nice in North London. I've just not found them yet.
Right. But I mean, technically, obviously, it's not North London, but technically, of course, you do recognize that Imperial College is north of the Thames.
Yeah, it's sort of West London. I think you have North, South, East, and West, so you can kind of put yourself into quadrants, but it's not proper North London, sort of Arsenal type places.
No, I appreciate that. It's just, I mean, if you use the Thames as your origin, as it were, then anyway. So that's my flippant comment number one. Moving to the slightly, but only ever more slightly serious aspect, you have all sorts of very interesting anecdotes and parenthetic comments sprinkled throughout the book. And one of them particularly caught my attention, but for a reason that
might be somewhat unique or at least different. You give some anecdote very briefly about someone called Polly Matzinger, who co-wrote an article with her dog to circumvent the single author policy of the journal. And then I looked it up in the footnote, and the journal was the Journal of Experimental Medicine. So that's an interesting story, but it prompted the question, why on earth did a journal have a policy against single authors to begin with? What's that all about? In my world, if you have a single author paper, you get kudos for that rather than having to circumvent it by pretending to write it with your dog. Or maybe her dog did all the work. I mean, what do I know?
It's strange. I don't think they have it anymore. And it may not. It's sort of the whole. She definitely did co-wrote it with a. Well, not co-wrote it. She put her dog on as a co-author.
Well, you don't know. I mean, that's the truth.
He may have done something. I feel like she was probably doing most of the heavy lifting. The reasons why, maybe it was just like a grand FU type gesture and she got caught. But then she got banned from writing for a long time afterwards. So I think. Well, she became quite famous off the back of it, so it sort of worked in what it was meant to do. And there's so many journals.
But that just seems very odd to me. I've never heard of anything like that, but I don't pretend to know how things work in the biological sciences. Is that common at all? Do you know of any other cases?
I don't think so, and not anymore, and certainly not now. I think you could very easily write a single author paper. I think it'd be challenging if it was a wet lab paper to actually do it. Like, I think the technical, being able to do everything by yourself, I think is very hard now. So I think it's more likely ruled out by we sort of live in this age of team science. But I guess you could do it on like a thought piece or an opinion piece, probably.
Right. Okay. So as we are careening ever so gently towards more substantial issues, one of the things that your book prompted me to think about, and maybe this is a stupid question, which is something that I often specialize in, but I'm going to ask it anyway, which is, how is infection defined exactly? So here's what I mean by that. So clearly, people conflate all sorts of things. They conflate infection versus disease. And we know that there's a big distinction there. And if we weren't, and by we, I mean just everyone, if we weren't sufficiently aware of that before the last 2 years, we're certainly aware of it now with the number of asymptomatic cases that we have with respect to COVID. And so I think everybody has some understanding that you can possess all sorts of different viral loads without manifesting any particular symptoms, and nobody even knows that they're sick. So there's a distinction that goes on there. So there's the basic question of, well, at what point, depending on the number of, let's just talk about viruses. So at what point with the number of viruses in your system, does that qualify as an infection? And this is highlighted by something that you wrote, which confused me. Or at least it sort of confused me. So I have an interpretation, and then I'm going to throw it over to you to answer. So you wrote, it's possible to have an infection without symptoms and develop antibodies detectable by the test. So that's along the lines of what we just talked about with asymptomatic cases. And it's possible to have had an infection with symptoms and not develop antibodies. So my interpretation of that was, well, what's happening there is that the innate immune system has somehow squelched the disease before it even gets to the adaptive immune system and your antibodies are being produced. So my first question is that right? And my second question is, based upon that, it again brings back this question of, well, at what point do you say that, yes, you're infected? Do you understand where I'm going with this?
Yeah. So starting on the first bit, there's a real heterogeneity of human responses to infection. I think that to exposure to a virus. So if you have enough virus that's replicating in your nose, say, and we call that an infection, then some people will make antibodies, some people will make T cells, some people will make nothing. And I think we're, with the amount of kind of screening and measuring, we're seeing that it is very variable. I think, you know, the textbook answer 2 years ago would be get infection, make T cells, make antibodies to everything you see. And I think some described it as a huge human experiment of the last 2 years. And experiment sounds wrong, but it's a kind of a measuring study on a scale that we've not done before, because we've suddenly got all these people with a known agent that they've not seen before. And we can see the high variability. And I think, yes, I think you might have people whose innate system controls it, or whose T cells control it without the role of B cells, or who don't have the right kind of repertoire in their B cells to pick up maybe that antigen. And the other things, we're not measuring the entirety of people's responses. So it may be that they're not making antibodies against the spike protein, which is what a lot of the assays are against, but they may be against the nucleocapsid or one of the other 12 proteins in the coronavirus. So there may be responses there that our assays aren't picking up. or they may not be making them. So there's a kind of huge breadth of things that we don't know. And then your broader question about what is an infection is really interesting and challenging, because I think we can see now with the tools that we have for detecting, and if we just focus on viral agents, you can detect viruses that we call pathogens in children all the time. So like 20% of kids, if you went into a primary school, 20% of kids would have RNA for a known pathogen up their nose at any one time. They're not necessarily symptomatic, but they could be infectious in terms of they have enough virus that when they play with their friends at the sandpit, they pass it on to the next person. So I guess, and it may not be an official definition, but my definition would be having an agent with the potential to cause harm that you can spread to another person. I think they sort of go back to the sort of Koch postulates, kind of that kind of classic idea. You may not need the symptoms, but you have the agent, you can take it from one person, put it in another person, and they'd have the same thing.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Another question that was prompted by your book, something that I wasn't aware of at all. I mean, there are lots of things that I'm not aware of. I don't have a biological background. I've just been, like a lot of people, I suppose, perhaps slightly more than your average person, but certainly like most people, frantically trying to learn about this world. To me, it's completely fascinating. I mean, I had a very strong sense of how come nobody told me about these things before. They're at earlier parts of my life. There's so much about the immune system, which is just remarkable, just completely remarkable. And I hope to get back to that. And I'd also like to get back to what you just mentioned insofar as this, the last 2 years having been a very rigorous and broad experiment from which we can learn all sorts of things. However, I'm drifting, as I tend to do. So a few specific points. So I knew proteins were made of amino acids, but I had a dim memory that an amino acid could be characterized or defined by a particular, you know, you have this chemical group and that chemical group and this other thing that varies on that chemical group, and therefore you have an amino acid. But what I wasn't aware of is that all the proteins in the human body and perhaps all sorts of life forms, maybe all life forms, I don't know, are comprised of just 20 different amino acids. And yet there are 500 amino acids or something like that that are actually found in nature. So that prompted the question, what's going on? Why those particular 20 amino acids? And I'm not looking for an answer. I mean, if you have an answer, that would be great. I would be somewhat surprised if anyone had an answer, although I haven't had any chance to look at this. But it just, that strikes me as odd and suggestive of something. And so I was just wondering about that as I was reading the book.
Yeah, no, I don't know. It may be to do with bioavailability or the energetics of, or the size of loading them up onto tRNAs. And I think once you get down to a common language of amino acids across all species, then you don't benefit from being the one that uses the other 20 because nobody else is making them for you. So there'll be some energetics in there as well. But yeah, no, it's an interesting question, but to which I'm not equipped to answer.
This is not in the spirit of trying to, you know, aha, you should know everything, because, you know, it's just, I think, well, that's odd. And you start thinking about these things and you perhaps have a tendency to think, well, you invariably have a tendency to think more broadly about something when you don't have any previous expertise. You're just coming in saying, I don't know anything about this. What's going on there? And you're willing to ask all sorts of questions that you might have taken on faith if you had had a more rigorous educational pathway, as it were. So here's something that I've been thinking about a lot during the pandemic, and I don't have any answers to. I think you do a wonderful job in your book highlighting the specificity of antibodies. And this is something that I think most people who don't have a background in this, they miss. They've heard of the term antibody. They have a sense that an antibody is a good thing. You want to have it to fight infection and this sort of idea. But the idea of an antibody being incredibly finely tuned to a particular pathogen and the degree of specificity that's involved in that is something that I think almost everybody misses. I certainly had no sense of it whatsoever. And I think you do an exceptionally good job of highlighting that. But that in turn makes me start wondering about, well, how does that work exactly? What are the mechanisms involved in antibodies neutralizing pathogens? And then I started reading more and I talked to a guy who's a researcher in HIV vaccines, and he starts talking about these broadly neutralizing antibodies, which seems to be at some level almost a contradiction in terms if you assume that things are so incredibly specific. Okay, so I should end with a question, which I understand is what you're supposed to do when you're interviewing somebody. But let's just take this notion of a broadly neutralizing antibody. To what extent is that coherent? Can you alleviate some aspect of my confusion? And maybe talk a little bit about the specifics of the mechanics of that. Because at some point in your book, you also talk about it's not just that it's targeted towards one protein, or at least it's not always targeted towards one protein, but you even mentioned some micro bits of amino acids of a protein, something like 10 or 20 amino acids that these particular antibodies are so incredibly finely tuned towards.
Yeah, so if we stepping kind of quite far back, if we took all of your blood out of your body and measured all of the unique B cells, you have 10 to the 15 different unique B cells. So you have this huge diversity. And the diversity is made by a sort of gene rearrangement. You basically have in the B cell gene, or the genes that determine B cells, you have a kind of a Lego box. When they're making the cells in the bone marrow, they pick, you have basically three buckets, a bucket one, bucket two, bucket three, called V, D, and J. And you pick one brick from V, one from D, and one from J. And then you stick them together slightly messily. And that gives you that kind of enormous diversity. So you have all these different B cells that theoretically could recognize a pathogen in the future. And most of them will just sit quiescent, will never kind of see their pathogen, because a lot of them kind of never see that kind of agent. If you then see the thing that your B cell recognizes, so say you've got a B cell in your body that recognizes it's called the receptor binding domain. It's the bit on the end of the spike protein that helps the virus get into the cell. So if you've got a receptor binding domain recognizing antibody, making B cell, if that sees the spike protein, that population expands in numbers. So you get lots more of those B cells, and that's what makes you have the antibody. But that antibody will only recognize that one region of the SARS spike protein. And if the SARS spike protein then changes that one region, and it needs to be quite big changes. So there are changes that it could make. So it could change its receptor binding domain. So the easiest way to think about it is you get some amino acids that have a negative charge and some amino acids have a positive charge. If it changes from strongly positive to strongly negative, it might repel the antibody. Like if you put two similar, if you've got a negative antibody that binds a positive spike protein, if you suddenly turn to a positive spike protein, like two magnets together, the things will repel, so it won't bind anymore. But if the virus changes its protein structure that much, it may be that the original function of the protein to get into the cells is also broken at the same time. So there's a kind of a space the virus can live in, and there's a space the antibodies live in, so they can talk to each other. So that's kind of where the specificity comes from. The broadly neutralizing antibodies are broadly neutralizing across multiple strains of the same virus. So we're now talking about antibodies against HIV. And the challenge with HIV is that it's a very variable virus. So there are more strains of HIV circulating in one person than there are of SARS coronavirus in the whole world. So there's huge variety in that. And the HIV virus uses a protein called the envelope protein to get into cells. So it's a similar approach to SARS spike, but it's called a different thing. What the ideal vaccine would be to recognize all of the possible envelope glycoproteins available out there in the world. And there are some regions in the envelope glycoprotein that are by force conserved. The virus has to use the same kind of tool set, like kind of kit of sequences, because otherwise it can't get into the T cells. So it can't infect cells. So if you have an antibody that recognizes this kind of key domain, then you could potentially kill all of the viruses. The challenge with that is that bit of the virus, that conserved bit of the virus that you want to target with your broadly neutralizing antibody, is beginning to look a little bit like a human protein. And your body removes a lot of the antibodies that recognize human proteins to stop autoimmunity. So the viruses evolve to mimic human proteins. And so you get into this kind of difficult space. And that's why very few people make these broadly neutralizing antibodies, because they are drifting into being autoantibodies and kind of you might start attacking yourself at the same time. So it's kind of there's an evolutionary challenge in there.
Okay. like all things in your field, it seems it's vastly more complicated than you first think. But let's put that aside for the moment, because here's my conceptual problem. The idea of something that's incredibly finely tuned so that it can be successful against a short string of amino acids, say, seems to be inherently contradictory with the idea of something rapidly evolving. So what it seems like you were saying to me is that notwithstanding all of the rapidly evolving, or at least evolving, many different strains of HIV in this particular case, they all have something in common, namely this envelope or whatever it is, the protein on the envelope against which one can mount an attack. And so the goal is, well, let's target that commonality and find something which can hit all of these different variants. And then the problem, as you were saying, is that you've got all these other problems like you always do. But do you understand what I'm saying? Like that conceptually seems a bit odd to me. If you have something that's varying, but at the same time, it's got this kernel of something which is staying the same and opening it up to a susceptible attack. So that seems odd to me. Do you understand my confusion?
Yeah, I think if it's coming from the host side, the reason for why the specificity is because the adaptive immune system is quite dangerous to you. So it can cause either kind of side damage, you know, inflammation, or autoimmune condition starts attacking itself. So it is very, very tightly controlled to stop it attacking everything. And that kind of specificity is part of that. It will focus only on the kind of on the pathogen side of things. The innate system is a bit more broad and recognizes like viral RNA or lipopolys, like chemicals that only bacteria make. So there is a kind of much more broad system from which the kind of pathogens can't escape. In terms of in that kind of virus and host evolution, we do see it, and I think we see it better in the way the T cells and HIV interact. So T cells are, there's a family of T cells with white blood cells, which are called the CD8 cells, and they kill infected, virally infected cells. With HIV, basically the virus gets into the cell, the infected cell then flags on its surface that it's infected, and it shows a kind of bit of the virus on the outside on these MHC molecules. The bit of the virus that it's showing, the T cells recognize and kill. But viruses that don't show that particular kind of sequence of amino acids and they change it, then don't get killed by the CD8. So they then kind of become the dominant population. And you get these rolling waves where the T cells kill most of the infected cells, a new clone of the virus escapes, that then reinfects more cells, then the CD8s come in and kill those. Eventually, the virus hits on a solution through which it can infect other cells and not be seen by the CD8 cells. So the reason why the virus evolves within people is because the CD8s are killing most of them and the virus is escaping all the time. And eventually it hits on this kind of perfect solution for the virus, which can get away from the CD8 cells and yet infect other cells. And that's normally when people tip in untreated from HIV into AIDS because their immune system can no longer cope and see the virus. So there are, yes, the virus has to kind of stick to this kind of kernel of infectivity, but there are more solutions in the virus than there are ability to see it in the immune system.
Okay, thank you. I have lots more questions, but I'm going to try to cut some of them short because we don't have enough time to cover all of them. I want to just maybe make a parallel note into the mRNA vaccines because that's another thing that everybody's talking about. And here's my sense of this moment in time and why I think it's significant. So I know that the concept of mRNA vaccines have been around for a very, very long time. I know that people have been thinking about them for cancer and they've been thinking about them for all sorts of things for a long time. But I think the idea of a successful mRNA vaccine is transformative. So I'm going to hold forth on why I think this is an interesting moment in time, and then you tell me whether I'm right or whether I'm wrong. So my sense is that unlike all previous vaccines that were designed to directly trigger an immune response by subjecting the immune system to harmless, let's say, or at least not terribly harmful copies of the pathogen, what these vaccines represent is an opportunity to directly harness cellular machinery by information that you're giving to them. So you're really harnessing the basic mechanisms of how cells make proteins rather than throwing something at the immune system and saying, recognize this. You're proactively using this notion of harnessing the information and capitalizing on the internal cellular mechanisms directly. Is that a fair summation?
Yes. And then, but you're still saying to the immune system, now recognize this.
Sure.
It's just that this is being made in the cells of the body rather than being injected into them. So you're kind of, it shifts where the manufacturing process is in a way.
Right. So I want to comment a little bit about the book, and I want to comment on the impact and the sociological aspects, because I think they're extremely important, and they obviously are things that you take very seriously, as well you should, given not only your professional life, but also the fact that you're a human being, like all the rest of us living in this time, and you had some very, I think, very insightful and important personal touches in the book itself. So I want to get to this idea of trust. The first thing I should say is that I was surprised by the lack of books such as the one that you have written. I would have thought that there would be far more readily available information for a broad general audience of how vaccines work and what we're doing. That's not in a simplistic 2-minute YouTube video, not that there's anything wrong with that particularly, but that would be much more comprehensive. And I was a little bit shocked by that, quite frankly. So I think it's wonderful what you've done. And I think you've done a very comprehensive job at being able to explain those things in an accessible way for people. But I was struck as I was reading the book, if you compare the sorts of information that you're giving in this book, which is, again, all too rare, with other popular science, there seems to be a real distinction. In physics, which is an area where I'm more familiar, there's a focus on what we don't know. There's dark energy. We don't know what the heck that is. There's dark matter. We don't know what that is. There's the cosmological constant problem. Gosh, who can figure that out? The origin of the universe, we're not sure exactly. Is cosmic inflation right? Is it wrong? Is, you know, all this kind of stuff. There's always this focus on what we don't know, sometimes too much so. And of course, in order to fully comprehend what we don't know, you have to understand what we do know. And that's often where popular science, I think, sensationalizes and lets people down, because you have to do a lot of slogging to be able to get there. But the focus is always on what we don't know at some level, even within the field. When I talk to biologists, the focus seems to be always on what we do know. It's like, look at us, we know this, you know, vaccines have done this, they're amazing. And so my point is not that we don't know a whole lot about vaccines, or that we haven't made just remarkable strides in understanding the almost inconceivable complexity of the human body in the last 100 years. That's obviously true, and it should be celebrated. But I'm getting almost a defensive thing when I talk to biologists, when I ask them, well, what about this? What about that? Let's talk about what we actually don't know. And I'm wondering if part of that, my interpretation of defensiveness, is the overwhelming relevance of this. Part of it is this idea that if biologists admit or talk about or focus on what they don't know, then they're worried that the public will, you know, the anti-vaxxers will go, oh, these guys don't know what the heck they're talking about. They're admitting that they don't know, and so forth. Do you think that that's a, so this was a very long question, I appreciate. Do you think that that's a fact? First of all, do you think that that's a thing? Am I misreading the situation? Is there something there? And if so, do you think my attributed justification for it holds any water?
I hadn't thought about it before, but now that you say it, yes, in the way that we outwardly present, I think we do tend to talk about knowns rather than the unknowns. I think maybe when we sit down together, we'll talk about the unknowns, or, you know, if we, and it may be a kind of, it may be that, it may be that you kind of, you keep your unknown questions to yourself because you don't want somebody else to go, oh yeah, oh, I hadn't thought about that either. I'll go and write the grant. You're like, damn it, I was going to ask that question. So I think there is that's really interesting. And I think there probably is a difference in the way we kind of approach the way we present our information. And it maybe is the immediacy and the relevance. You know, if I admit that we don't know about how black holes form, it's not going to, people are not going to change their trip to Tesco.
Exactly.
But if we say, well, we think it works like this, and I think that's probably, it is a bad thing. I think we do need to be clear that science is messy, and you know, we just lived through the follow the scientists, but there isn't a scientist. There's, you know, we all have different opinions. It's really challenging because it's almost like there needs to be a core public health message which should be put across. And it's very hard then to have other people kind of saying, well, we're not quite sure about this. We may not agree with like the central tenets of it, but as soon as you start disagreeing, then there'll be like prominent scientist X from prominent university Y disagrees. So therefore, I shouldn't wear my seatbelt, or it's okay if I start smoking. And I don't know if it then opens us up to problems in the future where, you know, we then do, you know, everyone's like, oh, what about thalidomide? Or, you know, what about, people used to say smoking was good. There's lots of stuff where thoughts change, and that's normal in science. And it may be we need better, it's not that you need better science education about the facts of science. It's the thought process that matters more importantly. And I think we're hoping to move towards that, at least at university level, where we now accept that you have the knowledge of the world in your phone. So there's no point in teaching people, well, go and learn the Krebs cycle, go and learn all 20 amino acids and their structure, because you'll never need that information in your head, because you can just, you can type it on something that you're never going to be that far away from something. So it's much more important to think about, well, how do I think critically about science? How do I integrate data? How do I work in a team? So and then maybe if that could filter down into more broader education, then you can start having this conversation and say, well, this is what we don't know. These are the boundaries. And you're right. There are lots of questions that I probably should have put in, of the kind of unknowns and the, like, what are the challenges?
It wasn't meant to be a criticism, but I mean, I know it came out that way, but that's not what I meant.
No. And I didn't read it. Like, I hadn't thought about it. And I'll admit, the writing was like 6 months of just get the information from my head onto the computer. So there was a structure, but it was like, and just go. So there, probably the time to have thought about it would have been, you know, February 2020. And it was just this different in the process. But,
well, but I think it's more than that. I mean, the book is obviously written. It's crazy for me to be arguing with you about this because you wrote the book and it was all in your mind. But nonetheless, as an objective observer, this book is written not just implicitly, but explicitly in the shadow of COVID-19. And people are confused and they're anxious and they're worried and they're looking for guidance and they're looking for understanding. And that's the dominant factor in the equation. And we all know that, and we all appreciate that. And that's why everybody, myself very much included, is all of a sudden Googling and reading books and reading articles about the immune system, which is something that I wasn't doing 2 years ago. I mean, that has to be understood. And not everybody has the time to be able to go into this. But there is something there that I find frustrating. And I just want to reiterate what you said about the process of science. And it's almost as if I get the sense that the biomedical community, when I hear this, is a bit insecure. They're saying things like, we're worried that people will say, wow, smoking was good for you one day, or you've made mistakes with things like thalidomide, or all these things that you've mentioned. Of course, when you're an expert, it doesn't mean that you're God. It means that you have the best understanding of the circumstances available. And it also doesn't mean that if you're an expert, you're not going to disagree with another expert, either on a small level or on a large level or anything like that. But you have to make decisions, and you have to make decisions not just scientifically, but in terms of public policy, based upon a responsible weighing of the current state of knowledge as you determine it objectively. And that's why expressions like, so there are two things about this that always irritate me when people talk about these things in the public domain. And one of them is this expression, trust the science. So that drives me round the bend, because that makes it sound like a faith. And I think what we're talking about is trust the process, as you were saying before. But that's, to me, almost indistinguishable from trust rationality, because that process isn't a process which is, in my judgment anyway, particular to science. It's a similar process that you use when you talk about history, or when you talk about political theory, or when you talk about anything. It's not singular or unique to science. It's just rational principles based upon gathering this whole idea of evidence-based research, which strikes me as one of the biggest redundancies imaginable. I mean, is there non-evidence-based research, right? So, I mean, there's the trust the science thing. Then there's another point which you also allude to, and you allude to it rightly, because this is what people are saying. So you have to mention it. People are saying, trust the science. And they're also saying, it's so hard to distinguish between good and bad information these days. And I think, really? It's not hard to distinguish. I don't find it hard at all. So maybe you can help me. I think that if this pandemic had happened 15 years ago or 20 years ago, say, it would have been a heck of a lot harder for me to get a sense of what's actually going on than it does now. I can go to the CDC website. I can go to the Mayo Clinic website. I can go to, you know, the Imperial College website. I can learn about these things. I can get a sense of what the prevailing views of the community are. I find it incredibly easy to be able to get a sense of what's reasonable information and what's not reasonable information. What's that all about? I don't get that.
I think that you may at least have the kind of tool set of knowing the places to trust. So if there was something that sounded like the Institute of Rational Science, or, you know, that if you're outside the community, the field completely, outside science completely, you may think, well, they sound as good as Imperial College. And some of the people who've kind of peddled some of the most nonsense are university associated. And I think that's where that may be challenging if you're not within the field. I don't know. I agree. I think, you know, look in the right places. Don't look in like weird spurious places or your cousin's Facebook page. Yeah. I don't know where that sort of failure is coming. And I think it's noisy, but not common. I think if we talk about anti-vax versus vaccine hesitant, there's a very small number of unconvertible, unrepentant anti-vax. Most people are hesitant, and some of that comes down to logistics or time. You know, if you look at why are undergraduate students not getting vaccinated, it's because they've not registered at a GP, because they're too busy, you know, and they've moved three times in 3 years. And So I think there's life things that get in the way as much. And to then kind of tar those people with like, oh, you're this bad thing, is counterproductive. And I think that then leads into like, I'm really opposed to vaccine mandates, for example. I think they are ultimately going to be self-defeating and will be harmful for the next thing that we need to, you know, people to buy in for. So sort of heavy-handed approaches are problematic. I think it indicates a failure of education and information if we can't persuade people to do this thing that's good for them and for their community. But, and then the other bit about the rationality is really interesting. I've been following like history podcasts, and their process is, like you say, it's really similar. It's like, but it just faces in the opposite direction. So science, you're facing forward and saying, these are the questions we don't know. History, this one's about the Second World War. And they're like, well, we don't know how the German army trained. It's like, well, that's only 60 years ago. How is that? It's like inconceivable that there's these mysteries so recently. So I think it isn't just follow the science. It's like, have a rational process about how you weigh up evidence.
Yeah.
And maybe that's what people need to be taught more.
Let me move to another question, something which has puzzled me. So in your book, occasionally there's mention of the Russian vaccine, the Sputnik vaccine, and the Chinese vaccine. As a layperson who's trying to navigate my way through this, I was frustrated by the fact that there seemed to be very little information about these vaccines. And it was really odd. It fractured on nationalistic lines, which, okay, to some extent is understandable, especially given the politics of Russia and the politics of China, and that these are not countries that are the most forthcoming and the most open with respect to their information policies. But that being said, there are also countries where there is biomedical expertise, where they have lots of people who have a great deal of knowledge. They're procuring vaccines, they're inoculating millions and millions of people with these vaccines. And I don't get any information whatsoever about how effective they are or to what extent they're similar or different than the vaccines that I'm familiar with. So there's this weird situation where you have a global issue, and then a core aspect of medical treatment to that global issue is divided on nationalistic and geopolitical lines, which strikes me as very, very odd. What was your response to this? Did you have similar frustrations? And am I missing something somewhere? Was there all sorts of analysis about how these vaccines compare to other vaccines, and I just didn't get it? But what's the situation there?
So I the last time I did a sort of deep dive to look for efficacy data was June, July 2021. And it was very hard to find any efficacy phase three, like proper clinical trial data about particularly the Chinese inactivated vaccines. I think there is some phase three for the Sputnik V vaccine. I think it's been published, but I can't remember. But no, I agree. It was very difficult to find information about the efficacy and the effectiveness of the vaccines. And that is unusual for something that has then been deployed so widely to not have the data must exist somewhere. And I think the clinical trials were registered. So I don't know, and it may have changed. I haven't looked in depth recently, but it was difficult to access data about them. Yes.
Two more questions, if I may. We touched on this a little bit earlier, but I was wondering to what extent you think the pandemic, and particularly living for 2 years through what we've all been living through, will have direct implications on interests and hearts and minds, if you will, of young people who are going into, or who might be more inclined to go into the biological sciences now than they would have been had something of this scale and magnitude not actually occurred. What sort of impact do you think the pandemic might have on triggering people's, young people's interest in the biological sciences? And how might we be able to harness that by improving the way we're teaching biology in schools?
Yeah, that's interesting. I gave a presentation at a school yesterday, more about kind of science careers, and it was largely people who wanted to do medicine rather than science. So it was maybe slightly different. I think they are very aware, though. I mean, they asked some quite astute questions about changing patterns of behavior around the coronavirus. I think living through something probably will spark more interest in it than maybe if it hadn't happened. So hopefully there'll be somebody who's kind of read these things and will be like, well, yeah, that's the thing I want to do, or at least raise the awareness that you can, that scientist is a job. I think one of the challenges we have is that people have heard of being a doctor. So if you're clever and you like biology, you become a medical doctor rather than becoming a biomedical researcher. So maybe just knowing that there are people who do kind of science as a job will open it up to a more broad, diverse range of people, hopefully.
Yeah. You make a distinction between medicine and biomedical research, and clearly that distinction exists, and yet it's a slippery slope, as it were. It's a rather fuzzy line between the two of them. And to that point, my final question is, throughout your book, there's a strong personal aspect that comes to the fore. You mentioned the formative experience for you was when your son was hospitalized with RSV, which you had been working on and continued to work on to a very large extent, and what that meant for you. You also reveal at the end of your book that you actually came down with COVID and the added perspective that that might have given you. To what extent do you think that personally being exposed to illness changes the outlook of biomedical researchers in general?
I don't know, actually. I'm quite detached from the subject. And so I think most of the time, I think of it as quite abstract problem solving.
Right.
I think there are other people who are more translationally or have a link because of a relative with a certain condition. Or it's such a broad church that people's motivations are different in different ways. And I think coming back to that kind of comparison of medicine versus science, I think some of it's down to training. Like the way you come out of a undergraduate science degree is different to how you come out of undergraduate medicine. And you may kind of converge later on if you both do research. You know, if you're a medically trained researcher or a scientifically trained researcher, you kind of get to the same place, but that's kind of 10 years down the track. But there is a different thought process, I find, between medically trained people and scientifically trained people.
Yeah. I mean, from personal experience, things might have changed a little bit since when I was in high school. But I'm not convinced of that, because I saw something very similar with my children when they went through high school. And there was this understanding or this idiom that in biology requires a lot of memorization, a lot of rote memorization. That was the idiom, that was the approach, that was the understanding. And that even led to a certain level of hierarchy, at least in my high school when I was younger, and this was, you know, a long time ago, this is 40 years ago or whatever, when I was in high school. But again, I'm not entirely certain that's changed, which is to say that if you were of a scientific disposition, or if you were said to be of a scientific disposition and orientation, and you were good at memorizing, or you were motivated to memorize, or you somehow had a tolerance for memorization, then you did biology. And if you were of a different persuasion, then you did physics. And so I had, as you know, I went off into physics, and it wasn't so much that I was terrible at memorizing. I was just incredibly lazy, and I didn't want to memorize anything, and I thought it was rather pointless. But what's infuriating to me is that's just so wrong. It's so wrong in so many ways, and it took me years, decades, to appreciate how wrong that was. Not that memorization is the greatest thing to be doing, but that's not part of what biological research really should be all about. And that was something that really drove me crazy, that there was this, there's this label that's attached to people. Oh, well, you know, if you want to do biology, then you have to be memorizing things. And maybe that's where the medicine biological divide, or at least one aspect of that, falls into play. Because if I go to my doctor, I want my doctor to be able to say something like, oh, you have this or that condition, or the chances are that you need this particular treatment or that particular treatment. I don't want my doctor to say, well, hold on a minute, I'm going to look that up. And that's reasonable. I want to have a certain sense of that. But in terms of the wonders of the biological world, I've long thought that, and really understanding the processes and doing research, I've long thought that far too much attention was paid towards naming things, knowing what the name of something is, taxonomy, as opposed to understanding the basic principles and recognizing the issues that are at play. And in keeping with what we had said earlier, recognizing what we don't know, recognizing the mysteries that are out there. And to my mind, it's, of course, every bit as analytical and every bit as principle driven, or at least should be, as physics. There really isn't a distinction between them in matters of process. Of course, there is in terms of the subject. But that's, I think, a really significant sociological fault line. So you have all these people of my generation, but also I think subsequent generations that say, well, I really like problem solving. I really like a first principles approach to things. But clearly, biology is not the thing I should be doing, because that's just all about memorizing. So I'll go off into physics. And then you have a glut of all these people, you know, looking at the first, you know, few microseconds of the universe or something like that. Not to say that that's a bad thing, but I wonder if biological research is not at a massive level really selling itself short.
Mm. No, you're right. The single cell is astoundingly complex. You sort of think of it as like a bubble diagram, like a fried egg with a nucleus and some a blank stuff and then cell membrane. But it's absolutely packed with proteins and structures and scaffolds and lipid bubbles and water and hydrophilic. And it's just like how anything happens in there is bewildering. You can't imagine it. So the complexity in that is as complex as, you know, the start of the universe. And so we should be applying that kind of level of thinking to it. I went to a talk the other day and it just added another layer on top of something else. I was just like, oh goodness, this like, yeah, it's, and sometimes you have to step back and say, actually, I don't need to know that to solve the problem I'm interested in asking.
Sure.
What we're trying to do educationally at Imperial is move away from the knowledge system, because, you know, like you say, all of the knowledge in the world is in your mobile phone. You don't need to memorize the Krebs cycle anymore. And I was thinking, you know, with your the doctor, you know, telling you stuff, if he stopped for a second and just said, oh, I'll just type the symptoms into this app, you'd probably feel more, you would feel less confident, but actually it's probably better if he's checking rather than just deciding what he thinks based on what he's seen before. So we are moving towards hopefully training people to think critically and how to access data rather than memorizing data. Unfortunately, the UK educational system at the moment has gone backwards and has gone much more into just memorize data and burp it onto a page. And that is not helpful. It only supports a certain type of person who then will go off and do a certain type of thing. So it doesn't add to diversity. And I think we do need a overhaul of the school exam system to bring it into line with the universities, which are then brought into line with what people need in the world of work. And they're slightly out of kilter at the moment. And so I think there is then this thing with biology where it is seen as, I think, because you can see what's happening, you know, physics, you get into the imaginary quite quickly.
Yeah.
Whereas biology, you can carry on seeing the experiment. So it's sometimes maybe perceived as a softer or a different. And like you say, yeah, the exams are different. You do more writing in the biology exam than you do in a chemistry exam. So there's just, it's pre-selecting in maybe an unhelpful way.
Well, I've really enjoyed talking to you, John. Is there anything that you would like to add, something that we haven't talked about enough or that you'd like to emphasize or something that perhaps we've elided?
I don't think so. No, it's been a lot of fun. It's covered lots of things I hadn't thought about in that way. So it's been really interesting. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this Pandemic Perspectives podcast. Once again, our Pandemic Perspectives documentary, released in early March 2022, is available for rent or purchase through the Ideas Roadshow app. while the accompanying book, Pandemic Perspectives, A Filmmaker's Journey in 10 Essays, is available in print and ebook through all major book distributors and an audiobook on the Ideas Roadshow app. See ideasroadshow.com for more details.